now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm back. Yes, that's right. It's me. And I apologize again for taking time off, but I was doing something I felt was important. I was joining my friend Dave Clark on his coast-to-coast walk. I didn't do the whole coast-to-coast walk because obviously I can't do it in 5 days. It's beyond even my abilities, but I did walk 90 miles in the space of 5 days, which I thought was pretty good. Dave Clark, of course, he was raising money for Parkinson's UK. It's a charity very close to my heart. Go to my Twitter account. You'll find I have a Just Giving page. Or better yet, give it to him because Sky, which has the most wonderful owner in the world, of course, they are matching every pound he makes on a one-to-one basis. So if you give me money, it helps. But if you give him money, it helps even more. Anyway, we've got a podcast to record. And I am supremely delighted to welcome back Stuart Robson for his first appearance this season. And in a week in which Arsenal actually played really well.
They did play well, didn't
they? I'm so looking forward to this. Also, as you know, we're all sad because Rory K. Smith has left us to move on to a better place, or a grayer place, the Gray Lady, in fact, the New York Times. So, of course, we have off-brand Rory. No, we're not going to call him off-brand Rory anymore. We have Ben Machel, who, of course, is the same shape and size as Rory. Maybe you're a little thinner, yes. Rory probably has better hair, though. And he went to a better university than you did, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And down the line, on his way back from Holland, it's Ollie Kay, and we'll be talking to him about all these Premier League clubs sending their promising youth players out on loan somewhere in the continent and elsewhere, indeed. But we're going to start in North London at the Emirates. Stuart! All right, I read a piece by somebody on another paper. I'll tell you who it is. It's Daniel Taylor. We have no problems or hang-ups about this. And he basically made the point that this was, he called it sort of Wenger ball at his best. Mm. This is kind of when everything works for Arsene Wenger, and they're fantastic to watch, and they rip teams to shred. It's not something that happens every week. If it did, they would have won more. But that was kind of breathtaking, wasn't it?
It certainly was, because they got everything right in the game. The closing down was good. They stopped Chelsea playing out from the back, so their organisation was quite good. And when they start to play their free-flowing counter-attacking football, when they dominate possession as well, they can cut anybody open. On their day, they're as good as any team in the Premier League, but they have too many off days, and that's why they haven't won titles before. But on the game against Chelsea, they were magnificent.
Ollie, is Stuart right? Is it a case just of sort of bottling this consistency?
Bottling is a word that has been used very often.
I meant it in the positive way.
Maybe in a different context, but yeah, it is precisely that. I mean, they have this sort of bizarre pattern to their seasons where you know, it seems to be in the middle of the season everything seems to be wonderful often, and then they just peter out towards the end, and it happens every year. It's going to be very difficult for them to actually win the league this season. I think perhaps it's been up for grabs at times over the last few seasons, not just last season when Leicester won it, but this season is going to be very difficult because Manchester City looks so much better, and what Arsenal have got to do is not just improve on what they did last season, which wasn't good enough. They've got to improve on, they've got to chase what is a moving target, and what, you know, the encouraging thing on Saturday was that they looked so hungry, so energetic, so dynamic, really, and that's that is progress. But they need to be doing it not just once a month or twice a month. They need to be doing it a lot more often than not.
Ben, you're kind of refreshing here because obviously Stuart, Ollie, and I live in a football bubble. You know about football, but you ideally have a slightly wider perspective.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, watching Arsenal at the weekend, it was back to the future. You did have that feeling of kind of you know, where you're just moving your head like that, like that, like that, like that, and you're sort of half grinning. It felt like you were, I mean, and it's easy to say, oh, it felt like it was sort of, you know, 10 years ago. But I guess the question that, not an Arsenal fan, that I would want to know is like, well, why are you turning it on now? This has always been what Arsenal have sort of talked up and what Wenger's always kind of wanted to serve. Why are they doing it now? Why wouldn't they be doing it last season?
There's a good reason for that.
Stuart's going to tell us.
Because Arsenal, and Arsene Wenger, his strength is that he allows players to play with freedom. He lets them express their flair. Their training sessions are all about being good on the ball, being good in tight areas. The problem that Arsenal have is when things don't quite work out for them, they have no structure to go back to. That's why you see them play badly every so often. If they could get that little bit of structure to go with their flair and imagination, they'd be a top, top side. But they've never quite got the balance right.
Why can't the structure be theoretically when things don't work? And maybe this with Alexis Sanchez, of course, started today. In fact, I'm not sure, has Giroud started yet this season?
I don't think he has started again, no.
Why can't the structure be, okay, well, we're not, it's not working for us, why don't we just lump the ball to the big man and he holds it up and gets fouled?
But it's not the structure in their attacking play, it's their structure in their defensive play, when they get played through and then they're all looking around, they're not sure whether to close down, to drop off, and that's when they get played around and that's when it looks as though they're an unbalanced side and a side that hasn't been coached particularly well. And it happens probably once every month, once every couple of months, and that's the problem.
I got killed on this podcast 2-3 weeks ago after Mustafi's first game for suggesting that the Mustafi-Koscielny tandem could be one of the top, or was one of the top three in the Premier League. People are like, oh, it's only been one game, which, you know, was kind of annoying because it's not like there's so many other super settled partnerships. Mm. But you've obviously seen Mustafi for Germany and Valencia and whatnot. Could this actually be a really good defensive partnership? And can you name three defensive centre-back pairings that you like more, just looking at their body of work and the traits of the players, that you like more than Mustafi and Koscielny? Can you name three?
No, I can't.
Can you name any?
Probably not at the moment. For their ability, their attributes, Mustafi and Koscielny could be an excellent, excellent back two. The trouble is, you could go and buy the best back four. If you're not doing enough work with them, and they don't work enough in training, they don't do enough work when they're going to drop off and get that understanding, which we've always talked about, Arrigo Sacchi getting at Milan all those years ago, and then George Graham doing at Arsenal. You can have the best back four. If they're not on the same wavelength, you'll still have problems. And that's why Arsenal has still had problems over many, many years.
Ollie, help me with this theme. How many centre-back pairings can you name that are better than those two?
Well, we don't really know an awful lot about them as a partnership yet. We don't know yet whether
no,
it's going
but
to
based
work.
On their individual attributes.
Yeah, the attributes are great. They're two really good, really understated, maybe in some ways less fashionable than a lot of the central defenders that are exchanging money, or exchanging big change for a lot of money these days. But they are both very good, solid defenders who do things, you know. No frills in some ways, but that sounds like faint praise.
Ollie, the one thing they haven't been tested with yet is that neither are magnificent in the air. So
away
from home against a team that have got a big striker and they get
Rondon.
And they keep getting balls into the box. Of course, you know, he's a determined defender in the air, but he's not got a great, he's not a massive height. He's got quite good spring. Mustafi, I think you could say the same in the European Championship. He was caught out a couple of times, got beaten in the air, I think, in the first game, and then maybe when he came on as a sub in another game. So that's the area they haven't been tested yet.
Mertesacker obviously was very tall, and you would say he ticked that box, but I would say potentially, I mean, I'm not one of those who thinks Mertesacker's some donkey or joke or whatever. I think he's been a very good player for Arsenal, but I could somehow, Mustafi, despite being shorter, would instill me with just as much confidence in the air and as well as being probably better in other areas.
Another point I think worth making on Arsenal, which I find interesting, is obviously we touched upon Giroud. I know a lot of people don't like him. I had a long conversation during my long walk with this guy who's a big Arsenal fan who kept insisting that if you don't have a 20-goal-a-season striker, then you're not going to win anything, blah, blah, blah. I pointed out to him that if Giroud played as many minutes as some other strikers, then he would have 20 goals. And besides, there's no real sort of, there may be correlation, but not causation, or the other way around. But he spends a lot of money on Lucas Perez. He still has Giroud. They're both fit. And yet he plays Alexis Sanchez up front. And Ollie, we have a little graphic here that in his first 100 appearances, Alexis Sanchez has actually scored one fewer goal than that Thierry Henry guy. Is this something we should expect again, Sanchez up front? Do you like this?
I do like it as an option. I don't think it's always worked, funny enough. But I thought when he first arrived that was going to be his position and he was going to take over from Giroud. A lot of the time it didn't work. It looked like they needed more of a focal point. But in that kind of game against a Chelsea team who were susceptible to the counter-attack and susceptible to being harassed when in possession, I think it worked really, really well. I think it worked a lot better than the Giroud option would have done in that particular match. And they need to be able to mix it up a bit. I think it's not always been with Arsenal about the quality of the players or the lack of quality of players. I mean, people, you know, Giroud gets a hard time for people, but it's often been about the predictability of the approach. And when Arsenal can mix it up a bit more, and when they've got Walcott on the wing and Walcott, you know, moving inside and Sanchez buzzing around and Ozil doing what he does so well, it looks really, really good. And yet there are times when, with very similar personnel, it just looks all a bit too predictable.
I wonder, Ollie, whether Arsene Wenger has had a look at Liverpool and the way they're playing without a main striker, and Firmino is playing as the furthest forward player, and they've got great rotation in the top four, whether he's had a look at that, and they got destroyed by them in the first game, and he's started to revert to Sanchez and his three players in behind him doing exactly the same thing.
You think Wenger takes his cues from Klopp?
You always, as a manager, you're always looking at other teams.
Do you think Wenger spent much of his career looking at other teams?
Not really.
Yeah, exactly.
Not really, but he made that on this occasion.
Hey, when I talk about Chelsea, Ben, what strikes me here is, first of all, anybody want to blame the manager?
Not for the performance, but what I'm going to say, the most disappointing thing for me, because I watch Juventus for every game for 3 years. I watched a lot of the Italian games when Conte was the manager. And I was telling people how they were going to play. Well, he's done none of the things that I thought he was going to do.
You mean like, you're talking about what, like the tactical hocus-pocus or the intensity?
The intensity, the tactical about playing with three at the back, playing with two up front. I almost knew where Juventus' next pass was going to be because you could tell they had such structure to their play and their philosophy of getting the ball into the front players with quality. And people will say, well, perhaps he hasn't got the back three of Bonucci, Chiellini and Barzelli. But when one of those was injured, he stuck with it, and Ogbonna came in as one of the three centre-backs, or Caceres came in as one of the three centre-backs. They played with wing-backs that were free-flowing, and I was looking forward to seeing Chelsea do exactly the same as I'd seen Juventus do for 3 years and Italy do for a couple of years under Conte, and he's done none of those things.
Well, I think that might have something to do with the fact that I don't think he even had enough bodies to play a back five until Alonso and David Luiz came in. Ollie, are you disappointed? Is it his fault?
I'm not disappointed with him. I would say I'm disappointed by what's happening. And just thinking about it and think about what we expected Chelsea to be this season with Conte, I think you can go back to the fact that he arrived in mid-July, and it's maybe 2 weeks later than most managers would have started pre-season. He was so wrapped up in Italy. I mean, he's not exactly the type of guy who would do things by half measures. And I wonder whether, similar to when Van Gaal came in late after the World Cup, I wonder whether having had that limited amount of time to make all his decisions, make his evaluations, and as well get his ideas across, I wonder whether it just isn't enough time for a manager who wants to do things so differently to what's gone before to make those kind of changes. And to me, they are not looking anything like you would have expected them to look, but they're also they haven't really gone in that direction. The defensive structure and so on, they're not really playing with great intensity, and it's hard to see what they're doing. It's almost like they've defaulted back to what they were doing badly before, which is again like the Moyes Van Gaal succession. So I think that is an issue, but it's also an issue that he spent all his time in August looking for certain central defenders and central defenders who could play in a back three, and wasn't able to get any of them in, and signed Luiz, obviously, and I don't go along with the idea that Luiz is the problem, but I don't think he's the solution either.
It's always a bad thing when, as a punter or a viewer who has never played football to any standard, you look at someone like Cahill and actually empathise and think, oh God, I know exactly how that feels.
You've been the tall, lanky kid who's been robbed by the little nippy gang?
Constantly.
Anyway, let's move on to Old Trafford, Manchester United and Leicester. Oh, look, here's another familiar England debate. Rooney dropped. Now, I haven't heard anybody, apart from Paul Ince and certain other people, who's made the case about why Rooney should have stayed in the side. I've actually, it's funny, Craig Burley made this point on my ESPN show, where he was talking about how you this weird dichotomy. You had a whole bunch of ex-pros turned pundits arguing that, well, you can't drop Waza because he can ping a pass and blah, blah, blah. And then you had the media that seemed almost in lockstep. Some media I don't read very often, but you didn't seem to have any journalist types arguing that, yeah, no, you need to build this team around Wayne Rooney. I'm going to turn to you, Stuart, because you can speak for all the ex-pros out there. Because, of course, you're very typical of the ex-pro in your views. And, you know, you never kind of go against the grain or anything in anything you say. I'm assuming you don't have a problem with Rooney being dropped. So I'm going to spare you that question.
Absolutely not. I mean...
But did you get that impression that there are a lot... You may not name names here because otherwise Paul Lintz might come around your house. But did you get the impression that there was almost like this sort of solidarity towards Rooney or the sense or...
But there is with ex-professional footballers. For some reason, for years, Michael Owen should never have been near the England side for 4 or 5 years. But every ex-pundit or ex-player would say, but he scored loads of goals. But he wasn't scoring loads of goals when he was playing at Newcastle, but he was still getting in the England side. When he was at Manchester United, he wasn't playing very well, but he still kept in the England side because pundits were still sticking up for him. There's no reason why Wayne Rooney should have been in Manchester United's team at the moment because he wasn't running beyond people, so he wasn't a threat in behind. When I've seen him play as a second centre forward and he's got his back to goal, he's now not strong enough or quite quick enough to hold up the play. People keep nicking it off of him. If he plays in a central midfield role, he can ping balls, but then you've got the problem with him defensively. And one of the reasons that Manchester United got so badly outplayed by Manchester City is because Rooney didn't know whether he was meant to be pressing the ball or dropping off into midfield to match up with Manchester City. And he gets that wrong so many times. I've seen it when he's come to Arsenal on occasions, when he's played as the number 10, where he's, you know, he'll run around and sort of, if the ball's close to him, and go and do some defensive work, but he's not consistent with his defensive work, and it leaves Manchester United often outnumbered in midfield.
Ollie, did you see the same dichotomy I saw, where a lot of people in the media were calling, or a lot of journalists were calling for Rooney to be dropped? You felt like all the ex-pro punditocracy was kind of rallying around him, except for Stuart?
Yeah, well, Gary Neville was on Sky. He said he made the point that it was an obvious decision to make and the right decision to make.
Can I just say something?
Gary Neville.
I think we all love Gary Neville. Correct me if I'm wrong, and I haven't followed everything he said, but it's one thing to go and say it after it happens and Mourinho's just won 4-1 against the defending champions. Who was calling it for him? Can we think of anybody who was calling for him to be dropped
on a radio station the night before the game?
Other than the angry, shaven-headed people from Essex here. But
no, I mean, I'm sure there'll be fans saying, hang on. We've been saying this for months.
Yeah, I know fans have done it. But it seems to me that it's almost like the people who haven't played professional football where we're sort of arguing this case, and the people who have... We're saying, no, well, you know, you need to hang on to him. And I don't know. I mean, am I misreading this, or was there...
Well, this is something that I wanted to ask Stuart. As a former professional, obviously you're different to a lot of the punditocracy we're talking about. But is there just something innately conservative about a lot of ex-players? Is there something kind of just not wanting to see change? Because obviously the media, we like stories. We want to see Rooney drop because it'd be fun to see him drop.
Because a lot of the pundits still probably want to, when they see Wayne Rooney, want to say hello to him and want to have a chat with him. And it's the same with ex-coaches and ex-managers. They all still want to be pally with each other. It's easy to criticise people that you're not going to see.
But they don't want to be pally with Anthony Martial?
No, probably not. No, because they've never played with him, and you know he's somebody they don't really know. I always felt sorry for the South Korean left back at Tottenham. Every time there was a goal conceded, it was the South Korean left back's problem. You know, not the other players that were playing that everybody knew.
But I think it's also a thing with ex-player pundits where often, you know, maybe they're sort of looking at it slightly vicariously and you know, reliving their own experiences, and they're very reluctant to say that a player is in decline. They're very reluctant to say they've been on that downward slope before, and they can empathise, and they think, well, no, it's not as simple as you being in decline. Rooney's been in decline for such a long time. People say, oh, he's been in decline for 2 or 3 years. He hasn't. He's been in decline for about 6, 7, 8 years. It's really obvious that to anybody, but I don't think that means he's a terrible player by now. I think he's certainly a player who should be in Mourinho's and Sam Allardyce's thoughts, but it's clear that he is in decline, and I think there is a real hesitancy and wariness among a lot of ex-players to acknowledge that, and I think it's really slightly weird, because it would probably help in some ways if people did say, well, look, he's in decline, but...
Rory Smith, that's another time we mentioned him. We wrote a piece about how maybe Rooney needs to sort of accept that his role has changed and he can still contribute. And I'm wondering, given that, you know, Zlatan is of a certain age, the other strikers at United, Martial or Rashford, have a slightly different skill set. I mean, maybe Rooney's skill set is closer to Ibrahimovic's than it is to Rashford's or Martial's. Is maybe his future as the guy who plays when Ibrahimovic doesn't play? Because I know Ibrahimovic played a lot of games last season, but it's kind of unreasonable to expect him to start 50, 60 games. Or maybe the guy when you want to go two up top or whatever. Is that a better role, or is that an insult to Wayne Rooney?
I don't see Wayne Rooney as a centre forward anymore, because he can't.
What do you see him as?
I see him as a midfield player. I thought he had his best games for Manchester United last season against weaker opposition when he was playing as one of the three midfield players, and his passing was excellent. He'd keep switching the play, he'd find the right pass.
So he's a guy who plays in midfield against bad teams who sit off you and he's got an hour on the ball. Yeah.
That's where I see him.
Ben, Mourinho. There's a theory going around that Mourinho, obviously, whether you like him or not, he's not wedded to Wayne Rooney. He brought in his own people. He has his people who play the same position as Wayne Rooney does. Was this a case of him giving Rooney enough rope to hang himself? In other words, I start with Rooney, things go predictably in this way, and then I can go and I can play Mata there or Mkhitaryan if I ever decide I like him again, or Pogba or whatever, and then I can do what I want. But first I have to go through this painful step, because I don't want to come in here after what I've been through and have a situation where I have, you know, the England captain and the Paul Stretford gang. We all saw what happened with Van Gaal. Not that I'm suggesting that they had anything to do with all the leaks about how evil Van Gaal was. Of course not. I'm sure it wasn't them. But could this have gone through the special one's mind?
Yeah, I think it definitely could have. I mean, now you put it like that, you can sort of... I can see that. It seems almost like maybe a bit of a dance. You have to go through the motions. It's like, I'll try them there. Do you take my point now? Can you see? It's almost, I was just thinking, because we talked about this the last time I was on, about the idea of managing Wayne Rooney's decline, even making those allowances, sort of saying, okay, well, you're not as good as you used to be, but maybe we could try you here, or maybe we could put you there. You know, a lot of other players wouldn't be afforded that. It's a bit like when your gran gets older and you sort of have to make her realise that she can't do these things that she used to do. You try and make it easier for her, but there comes a point where you're like, you're just a bit too old. You can't go out to the pub by yourself like that anymore.
United, I thought, played really well. I thought Mourinho was actually correct when he said that, you know, they scored all those goals on set pieces, but it was a result of the way the intensity with which they played and whatever else. They're maybe an issue. Nobody seems to remember Mr. Martial, who, you know, a year ago we're talking about, oh, look, they spent so much money on, oh, but he's brilliant. He's the best one, top five strikers in the world. There'll be time to get into see how he manages that situation. So I do want to talk a little bit about Leicester. Last year they had all these, you know, it seemed like Morgan and Huth got to sort of every ball in the air. Obviously you can see three goals on set pieces, and one of them to Pogba, who's admittedly very tall, but not exactly great in the air. Robbie Savage was on Match of the Day 2 last night. Yeah, that's it.
Why did you start with a chuckle?
No, because I want to get your... Because what he said to me didn't make... Basically, he sort of suggested that it's the new rules about holding, that they're not allowed to hold people. He showed us an example. They're fined defending last year, the West Ham game, where I thought they should have had five penalties called against them. And he says, this year they're not doing it, and they're not getting touched tight and all this stuff. You saw the goals. Is it as simple as sort of bad set-piece defending because, you know, Robert Huth can't get inside Zlatan Ibrahimovic's shirt anymore?
No, that's not the reason. The reason is that they lost concentration. There wasn't enough determination when the ball came in the box. You can forget all when people talk about zonal marking and man marking. Once the ball's in the air, man marking goes out the window. Once the ball's kicked, man marking goes out the window. It's you attacking the ball, you being first to it. It's in your vicinity. You go and win the ball. And at the moment, Leicester aren't doing that particularly well. Fuchs got beaten to the ball by, I think it was Pogba. You know, when Pogba runs across him. His starting position was wrong, and then he didn't attack the ball as much as Pogba did. It's all about the determination, and Leicester, all around the field this season, without Kante as well, aren't defending well enough in the front areas, in midfield, and at the back. The set plays are just one instance or one sort of example of it. They're not defending as well as they did last year for whatever reason. maybe they've gone a little bit soft. Maybe the players, they always had something to hold on to last year. They were top of the table and we can hang on to this. Come on, another game. They've had a poor start to the season in pre-season. They kept on losing. I think they've lost confidence and they've lost the sort of mentality that we will not be beaten. And at the moment, they're not defending well all around the field. And last season, with Kante in midfield, they could afford just to play two in there. But with Amati and Drinkwater, now with Slimani playing up front with Vardy, they're going to be outnumbered in midfield. The same reason that Manchester City dominated Manchester United dominated Leicester.
Yeah, Ollie, it seems to me that if you play Slimani up front with Vardy and you drop Okazaki, who ran like a lunatic last year, and there's no Kante, you're putting a tremendous amount of strain on your midfield, especially if you keep the same wingers you already have. Is this something Claudio needs to wrap his head around?
Well, when they signed him, it seemed like, you know, that was going to be an option for different types of games. And that guy who would sort of win balls in the air when they were playing against teams who defended deep against them. And we saw the game against Burnley the previous week. And obviously there were a couple of goals on the counter-attack, but the ball's into the box.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
That's where Slimani came to life, and I can see why he represents such an upgrade from maybe Ochoa in that position, but I'm surprised that effectively, you know, the formula that they had last season, which was Okazaki off Vardy, I'm surprised that when they've lost the work rate of Kante already, the energy of Kante, that they would go to, you know, more of a 4-4-2, really, and more of a two focal points in attack rather than Okazaki playing off him as he did before. But it's I think, as Stuart says, that, you know, they have lost, you know, they've lost a lot of work rate from that 11, and the work rate was clearly a huge part of what they did. But I think there's also, isn't there also something where gradually there has been an erosion of the sort of impregnable belief that they had last season? And they were, you know, there was something, you know, there's that American phrase about people being in the zone. Well, I've never seen any team being in the zone like Leicester were last season. And then having had to adjust to a new season, new expectation, a couple of the best, well, Kante's gone and changes to the team. I just think they are no longer in the zone.
We're going to move on to our debate this week, which isn't really a debate, of course, but it's a chance to talk about a really, I thought, interesting piece that Ollie wrote in Monday's game. Basically, Ollie, you traveled to Arnhem.
Enschede,
the former stomping ground of Steve McLaren. Remember him? Mm. Where Twente played Vitesse Arnhem. And the interesting thing is, obviously, people have sort of sussed out, I'm not sure how I can say this without getting in trouble legally, but Vitesse are owned by a man who is perhaps friendly with the Chelsea proprietor, Roman Abramovich, so much so that he sent at least 20 players have gone there from Chelsea. And at Twente, there are several Man City guys as well, including Bersant Celina, who you may remember some of his first team appearances last year. And Ollie, can you explain what you were trying to do in going there? And some of the things you wanted to raise.
Yeah, well, it was obviously for the reasons you've mentioned. You know, that there are six players from those two teams at those two clubs: three from Man City at Twente, three from Chelsea at Vitesse. And I just thought it seemed like a really interesting situation. You know, a sort of anonymous, unremarkable mid-table Dutch game in which sort of six of the bright lights of the much vaunted academies of City and Chelsea were playing. So I went along and spoke to a lot of people. I spoke to the technical director of Twente, and I spoke to Lewis Baker, England under 21 player who's at Chelsea and who's gone on loan to Vitesse for the second successive season. And I have an instinctive distrust or disapproval of not so much the loans, but just the incredible stockpiling of talent by those two clubs, young talent, and the fact that there seems to be sort of no real pathway. And I wanted to really get a sense of what they were doing there, how they were doing there, whether there is any sort of light at the end of the tunnel, whether this is benefiting them or their clubs or the loan clubs in any particular way.
Okay, so I agree with Ollie on most things. This is one area where I disagree with him quite starkly. But Ollie, I just want to, before we have a debate here with the guys, but I want to ask you a question about this, because I know we have this idea of the youth academy producing players for the first team, and that's wonderful, and the best academies produce the most youth players. But would you say that Barcelona and La Masia are one of the best youth academies in the world, if not the best?
I would.
Other than Sergi Roberto, who is a midfielder now playing right back and who I think by now is like 23, 24 years old, do you know the last player before him to be a regular at Barcelona was, to crack the starting 11? Yeah, who's pushing 30. Mm. Is part of the argument that the reason Man City and top clubs say is that the game has changed. And post-Bosman, with so much money flowing to the top, if you look at the very, very best teams, they just have so much talent that they almost become victims of their own success. That's why these people don't go into the first team, but hopefully they can become useful top-flight professionals.
I totally recognize that, but my point then is, well, why sign 50 of the best kids aged 60, you know, 18 to 21?
One of the reasons, Ollie, is because a lot of the scouts don't back their own judgment. And it happens, you know, at first team level, but it happens particularly at youth team level, because they want to make sure they don't miss out on these players. So instead of saying, there's the six best players in the country, we go and buy those six best young players, because that's what most Man City and Chelsea do and Arsenal do. They don't bring their own players through. They buy them at 15, 16. So instead of saying, there's the best six, they say, well, there's the best 50, and hopefully one or two of those might come through. So they don't back their own judgment in saying they're the best six. They sit on the fence with some of these players, and that's why they take so many.
Chelsea in particular. Chelsea have won, I think it's five of the last seven FA Youth Cups. They've won the UEFA Youth League the last two seasons, despite having all of, you know, so many of their best young players on loan. They have got so many of the best young players in Europe, certainly most of the best young players in England, and their careers don't progress. You could say, oh, well, what about Patrick Van Aanholt? He's at Sunderland now. He's having a career. Jeffrey Broomer, he's having a career. But I would say a youth academy's responsibility is to try and get, it's not necessarily to make players for their own first team. That's obviously the holy grail. But the responsibility, the duty, is to try to create careers, try to develop footballers. And what clubs are doing, and Chelsea and Chelsea in particular are culprits of this, is they're developing really good players up to 16, and then those players are just stagnating because there's
It also looks, Ollie, as though they don't trust in any player that hasn't played at the the top flight football, because you just mentioned in your piece Matic, you know, had to go away from Chelsea to go to Benfica, I think it was, for him to be bought back. Kevin De Bruyne, you know, he wasn't good enough for Chelsea, or so they thought. They sold him to
De Bruyne is a slightly different case, though, because he wasn't a youth academy product, and also there was a personal issue with him and the manager.
But he had to go away, and he went to Wolfsburg, and then suddenly he's a top-flight player, and he gets bought, and he's probably the best player in the Premier League at the moment.
Ryan Bertrand's is another example, of course. I think he made his debut in a Champions League final, no less. Ben, I'm not really comfortable with people saying, like, ooh, what you're doing is bad for football. I mean, these players who go to Chelsea or Manchester City, they get amazing high-end training. You can argue that maybe some of them get huge contracts early and so they're not hungry enough and blah, blah, blah. But I just don't know that since the big investments in the academy have happened, when sort of the first batch of people were 16-year-olds sort of 6 or 7 years ago, I don't know that we have enough of a sample that we can go and say, you know, these players have been ruined.
No, I know what you mean. I agree with Ollie in that a lot of how you feel about it is going to be instinctive. And when you look at the numbers, you know, if you happen to, say, be prone to scouring Wikipedia for football tidbits, as I sometimes do, and you look at, okay, who do Man City or who do Chelsea have out on loan, and you see how many people are, that some, there is a part of it that says that's a bit creepy.
Why? If you were a young player, a 14-year-old young player, and you were at West Bromwich Albion in their youth academy, yeah. And you were their number one player, and Chelsea came in for you at 15 and said, you know, we're going to offer you a load of money and we're going to put you into our academy, what would be best for you? I know what I think would be best.
What?
Izzy Brown should have stayed at West Bromwich Albion.
Yeah, where now he could work under Tony Pulis. Well, that would have been fantastic for his career.
It's better than it is now.
Is it?
Yeah, he won't play for Chelsea.
So what? It's not like Chelsea's the only football club in the world, but he can make out...
Why do you think that... You obviously think that Chelsea, Arsenal, Manchester United, Manchester City have the best academies. Who says that?
I don't necessarily believe that.
You just said high-end coaching. Who says it's high-end coaching? Who says that Arsenal's academy is better coaching than Leicester's academy?
Okay, I don't say it.
Because it's not actually right.
Okay, well, but then, listen...
They buy the best players at 14. They spend fortunes on getting the players
and they give them excellent facilities and they give them the opportunity...
Facilities don't make good players. Excellent coaching makes good players.
But that's fine. But then why doesn't everybody just keep playing for the village pub team until they're 21 and then they can all go and have trials at big clubs and we see who's good? I mean, I don't...
What I'm saying to you is that other clubs are developing them and then Manchester City, Chelsea and Arsenal are buying them at 15 years old. So the development has taken place between 8 and 14, 15.
Listen, I completely understand that. That's a little bit like saying that, you know, if Eton takes all the cleverest kids in the country or the kids that they think are cleverest at 15 and then they come out and they all become important, successful people, then, well, is it Eton or is it this natural preselection? I completely give you that. But there's no denying the fact that when they're at Eton, they have access to high-end educational opportunities, which might not exist elsewhere.
Yeah, but then they send them on loan to a series of failing academies. You know what I mean? It's not just that they stay.
So that they can experience the real world.
So which?
But Eton ends at some point, right? It's not like you can stay in an academy forever.
But do you not feel that when you look at the career path of someone, I don't know, like Patrick Bamford, there's just a slight sense of melancholy. You just see all the places they've knocked around. You know, they say, okay, I'm on the books of Chelsea. I've been here. You think, is that what sort of identity? You know,
I don't know. Ollie, you know more about this because you know more about the lower division than I do. Didn't Patrick Bamford go somewhere in the Championship and score a billion goals and have a really good season?
Yeah, he did very well on loan at Middlesbrough. So
what's Middlesbrough? Like Outer Mongolia? Is that like is that a turd of a football club and it doesn't matter?
No, but my problem with this, and you know, you talk about high-end coaching and this kind of thing. There are players here. I mean, Matej Delac, okay? He's a Bosnian/Croatian goalkeeper. Signed for Chelsea in 2011. He's now on his ninth loan move, 24 years old. I'm not sure he's even had a day's training at Chelsea. Ulises Davila, Mexican midfielder, 4 years at Chelsea, four loans, now playing back in Mexico. It's not just Chelsea who do this, but Chelsea are the extreme example. And if you look at those players, I mean, you accept that every player who's excellent at 16, 17 isn't necessarily going to be a great player when he's 21. But there are so many top international youth prospects and English youth prospects and local youth prospects have signed for Chelsea in particular and have seen their careers just stagnate between 16 and 21 and to the point where they're playing at a much lower level than you would have expected them to. You accept that Patrick Bamford's level might be Championship, but when it's happening almost every time, you know, there are so few players playing at Champions League level when they've been among the best in Europe at 16, 17. And I think they would have been, probably, hypothetically, most of them would have been better off not going to Chelsea. They might be poorer, but they might be at better clubs now.
You know what I think, to do this properly, and I invite maybe our bosses want to give us the resources to do this, or maybe somebody with, maybe some Bill Edgar type wants to get stuck into this. I think to really go and study this, I think, with a modicum of rigor, we should go back and look at really what the hit rate is for the people we think are really good at 15 or 16. You know, we should go back and look at, you know, England schoolboy squads from the past and see how many of those people actually made it. If we assume that, for example, England, you know, whatever, under 16s are a group of the top 20 players in that age group, which may or may not be the case, and go back in the day when they all were at different clubs, how many of those guys made it?
I can give you an example. I was the England.
Did you do some youth coaching? Were you an England? Were you an England youth captain at some point?
I was the England youth captain for 2 or 3 years, and most of the players under John Cartwright would go on to play first team football, and they were disappointed if they weren't in the first team by 17, right. 18.
What percentage of the Premier of the top flight were foreign at the time?
Not very many.
Exactly.
You know, at that time, they were picking the right players to go and
Can I point somebody else out, since everybody's all about, like, oh, they're going to get the about 16-year-olds? There was a guy, a very tall boy named Tammy Abraham, who joined Chelsea in 2004 when, according to Wikipedia, he was 7 years old. This dude is now on loan at a club called Bristol City, which I believe is somewhere. Is that in League One or the Championship?
That's in the Championship.
That's in the Championship. That's the second tier of English football. All right. So this dude, who's 18 years old, has scored 7 goals in his first 9 appearances this season. Mm. Would you say that's
okay? I'll give you the other side of it.
But next year he's going to Vitesse Arnhem and become rubbish.
I saw him against Manchester United in the under 21 game, and he was brilliant against Manchester United's under 21. And the next Saturday, when he could have played for Chelsea because they were short of a striker, they played Alex Pato up front, Chelsea did, who Alex Pato is way, way past his best. Tammy Abraham, on that day against Manchester United, okay, on his performance, he should have been in the first team.
Was Mourinho still there, or was it Hiddink?
I think it was Hiddink.
Okay, well, I mean, that's by the by. I think... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask, is there another side to the, you know, the idea that these clubs are stockpiling young players, not letting other clubs have them? Because if it's as you say, that we're just trying to get as many, you know, taking a punt on quite a few, developing them as best we can, then you can say, okay, that might not be the best for them, but it's not cynical. If there's a sense of, we're going to get them so that, you know, another, you know, so that Middlesbrough can't get them, or that, you know, Everton can't get them, then if there's any suggestion of that, then I think you'd have to say that's legitimately bad, because that's not their best interest. You're just trying to get... Because you're taking a young player on, so to put them out of circulation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Corbyn. Maybe the government should go and decide where young players can go. And it's not, it shouldn't be they or their families who at 16 decide, no, you can't go here because they already have too many good young players. No, why don't you go and play? Seriously.
If we're talking about whether this is a good or bad thing, I'm saying if there was a suggestion that was going on, then you can't say, oh, well, you know, fair enough from that, because we'll just let money talk every time.
Well, it's not money. It's also opportunities. If you've got a gifted, if you have a gifted, you've reproduced, right? You've got a child, right?
Two.
Boy or girl?
Boy and a girl.
Imagine your boy reaches 16 years old, and let's imagine it's some sort of fantasy world where Leeds United become one of the biggest clubs in the world again.
Again, thank you.
Exactly. And he goes to Leeds United at 16 because Leeds United are stockpiling young players. Yeah. And he gets there, and there's 11 people who are better than he is because they've been stockpiling young players. Mm-hmm. And he signs a massive contract. Are you going to tell him, yeah, go ahead, Ben Jr., stay there, and don't play for 2 years, because that's going to do wonders for your careers? Or are you going to say, hey, Leeds, I want my kid to play football because he's 16 years old, and so can we get him somewhere else where he can actually get on the pitch? Wasn't that a normal decision that somebody would make?
At that stage, but I would suggest that you wouldn't go to Leeds, if they were stockpiling, you wouldn't go to Leeds United in the first place. You'd go to somewhere where you thought you had a chance of getting in the first team.
Well, obviously you would, because...
Isn't the thing to do to then just, if you're going to crunch the numbers, just look at, okay, we'll look at the players who are coming through into the Premier League, who are young in English, or young and developed in England, and sort of say, well, what route have they taken? How many of them have come from the Chelsea or Man City?
Yeah. I think you'll find that when you do things like that, you'll find that the vast majority have come from, or not vast majority, but a big chunk have come from Manchester United. Some have come from Arsenal. I mean, the people have done these studies over time. Then on European level, in the same way, people say, you know, look, Barcelona stockpile youth players, but then, you know, Barcelona and Real Madrid, it's something like, I think it's something close to 20% of the players in the Spanish first division have spent time at Barcelona, Real Madrid. Is that necessarily a bad thing? Has it hurt Spain internationally to the fact that the Spanish national side haven't won major trophies? Right, how about some quick hits? Liverpool romped to a 5-1 win over Hull City, and everything is Klopp-tastic. Ollie, 74% possession, 32 shots on goal. This is heavy metal football at its best. What could possibly go wrong?
That sounds enormously similar to the statistics that they had when they lost at Burnley and were slaughtered for being inept. I mean, dominating possession and creating those goal-scoring opportunities is great as long as you put them away. And in the last
few games, they've been so clinical and so impressive in their forward play. They are playing really, really well. They've played really well, five games out of six. But will they win the league? No, I don't think they will. Are they as good as Manchester City? I would be very surprised if they were to win the league. They've got a good chance on current form of making the top four, which would be a great season.
I think we're all on the Klopp bandwagon, aren't we? Even Stewart.
Yeah, he's done well.
Would you swap Wenger for Klopp?
Of course.
What a surprise. Manchester City make a 10 out of 10 in all competitions with a win at Swansea. We're sort of taking this for granted here, Ben, but have you been totally seduced by the Pep?
Yeah, completely. And it's ironic that I have been seduced, because I think the thing that I like about him so much is that he's not pretending to have a love affair with Man City in the way that some other managers might pretend to be, you know.
You're talking about Klopp, are you? You are? You're having a little go at Klopp?
No. I love Klopp. I'm seduced by Klopp. I'm easily seduced. But
clearly.
It's just the fact that he's so clearly there to do a job. And there's something appealing about that. You know, it's almost like a highly qualified tradesman who you get in. And there's just something very nice. You kind of feel like you know where you stand. And it's also, I just love the fact that it's not just what he's done with Sterling, but also what he's done with Hart. You know, he's not kind of piddling around. He's actually doing something. So, yeah, totally.
He doesn't pretend to be your friend. He comes in, he does the job professionally. If over the 3 years, Pep also falls in love with
me,
with Man City, great. But it's going to be natural and he's not going to fake it.
Exactly.
Plenty of stories last week about how Francesco Guidolin needed to beat City to save his job, which I thought was kind of a stupid premise. Oh, yeah, here, go. You need to go and beat these guys. They're so much better than you. With Ryan Giggs holding talks with the club last Wednesday, according to Alison Rudd, although, funnily enough, I also saw a report saying that Giggs denied it. So, I don't know. Stuart, does Guidolin deserve to go, and is Giggs an upgrade?
I'm not sure Giggs would be an upgrade. Guidolin, the only thing I would say about Guidolin, I liked him when he was managing in Serie A. I can't see an identity at Swansea at the moment. For 4 or 5 years, you could see exactly what style of football they were trying to play. They looked really good when they were counter-attacking, the two wide players, the centre-forward. They had an identity. Under Guidolin, I don't think they've got an identity, and that's a worry.
Heung-min Son scores twice and now has as many goals this year as he had last season. And Spurs beat Middlesbrough 2-1. And guess what? They're up to second in the table. So there. Ollie, did Son get a bit of a raw deal last season with people criticising, saying, oh, how can he back up Harry Kane? And I'm also wondering, I mean, he can play up front. He's been playing a little deeper. But should they just make him Harry Kane's reserve rather than this Janssen guy?
Well, I think it's important that they signed Janssen a more of a specialist centre forward, just to lighten the burden in terms of goals and games, because as it's happened, Kane has got injured very quickly. But Son is one of these players who I never see play badly. I know he got a bit of criticism last season, but whenever I saw him live, he was really good. And maybe another like Lamella who needed to bed in a bit slowly, but the quality was always clear and it's showing consistency now.
No trouble, as far as we know, at the Olympic Stadium, or the London Stadium, as they so imaginatively call it, until they go and whore out their naming rights. Other than West Ham being atrocious and losing to Southampton. Ben, what's the problem? Do you want to delve into that? Do you think it's God punishing the pornographers? Mm-hmm. Or would you rather just pray Southampton and be good, Ben?
Everyone prays to Southampton. Southampton are good. But in a way, I mean, it would be great if it was the stadium for West Ham, because that would be something that I could, you know, deal with. I could knock it down and build a new one and be good.
You think it's the owners and Karen Brady instead?
It's just really bad. I don't know. There's just bad vibes. You know, you could say, oh, well, you know, they're defending terribly, not scoring, and the captain's saying that they're defending laughably and all the rest of it. But it's from the outside looking in, it's quite hard to put your finger on, because it's not just what's on the pitch. I mean, there must be. You get the sense that there's sort of some voodoo going on, but I wish I could tell you.
Bournemouth upend Everton 1-0, and somebody named Harry Archer, who I'd say somebody named Harry Archer, but I think we've got to know him and realize that he's actually a very reasonable player. I think a guy who cost him just $5,000, mm-hmm. if Wikipedia is to be believed. But Stuart, I'm guessing you'd rather talk about Jack Wilshere for obvious reasons. Is this the place for him to relaunch his career?
Well, firstly, I'd like to talk about Harry Arthur, because I saw him as an 8-year-old playing for Charlton's youth side.
Oh, stop it!
Yeah, my son also was playing for Charlton's youth team. And
who
Harry
was better,
Arthur,
your son or Harry Arthur's son?
Harry Arthur and my son played for the same
youth
side.
Who was better at age 8?
Oh, Harry Arthur was a very, very good player. He was the best player in the
side.
Even
though your son presumably has better football-playing genes than Harry Arthur's son, Harry Arthur's dad is probably like a...
He's actually a taxi driver. Anyway, But I saw Harry Arter as a very young player, and he went through the route. He couldn't get in Charlton's first team. He then went to elsewhere, and then he went to Bournemouth. And there's a player that's now developed into a very, very good footballer. And I would never have said he'd have gone on to become a Premier League footballer. So he's improved since he's been at Bournemouth. As for Jack Wilshere, I think it's the right club for him. He'll play more often than not. He'll be able to dominate in a second centre-forward position, a number 10 position, which suits him quite well. And I think he's playing under a manager that will make him more disciplined defensively than he was at Arsenal under Arsene Wenger.
Gab, this is one for you, actually. There's obviously no Colin this week because of you're walking in the north of England.
But, for charity?
For charity.
Can you still donate?
Can still donate online. Is it on your Twitter page?
Yes, it's pinned.
But that notwithstanding, I hear it's now two games in a row without a win for Real Madrid, and Ronaldo doesn't seem too happy about it.
He wasn't happy because he was substituted with, I think, 18 minutes left to go against Las Palmas, and he seemed to sort of throw a strop at Zidane on the bench. And obviously the next day, Zidane said, no, everything's fine, nothing to see here. Ronaldo's mom went and tweeted and said, chin up, lad, basically, except she did it in Portuguese. It's a curious situation because Real Madrid are top of the league. They're ahead of Barcelona. They have a huge game coming up against Borussia Dortmund away, which actually matters because in their first Champions League game, they were losing until 2 minutes from time at home to Sporting Lisbon. Zidane's got this tricky job of trying to manage Ronaldo and Karim Benzema. He didn't really get much help from the signings in the summer, just Morata and Asensio coming in. He's rotating a little more. I think this is just one of those things where Ronaldo's been substituted twice this season, which is as many times he was substituted all last year. And incidentally, last year, those two substitutions were the last two games before the Champions League final when they were arresting him. I think that's all it is. I think this is major mountain out of a molehill, but of course, Spanish media are having a field day with this. Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many, many thanks to my kind and excellent guests this week, Ben Machel, Stuart Robson, and on his way back from the beautiful country that I like to call Holland, it's Ollie Kay. Remember, it's just £12 for a 12-week trial. Just search The Times online. If you enjoyed Ollie talking about his trip to Holland as much as I did, and you haven't done so already, you can go online and read his piece. You can read lots of other things. You can read Henry Winter, a bit of Matthew Syed talking about, this is quite a touching piece this week, talking about his relationship with Joey Barton, and the gentleman from the Sporting Chance Clinic who passed away a few years ago, Peter Kay, who has done a lot of really important work with athletes. So you can press that subscribe button wherever you choose to download your podcast, and you can subscribe to our podcast. We're going to be back next week. Till next time, bye-bye.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.